This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
So good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
And those of you who are online, you can hear me?
Yes.
Oh, good, good. Thank you very much. I always, I'm nervous now because I did a ceremony in May. And it turned out that we thought we had everything set up on the laptop for this huge ceremony and found out later that not only were the participants muted, but we were muted too. So no one heard anything. It was very disappointing for those who are online. So good. Just a quick note has to do with a form. For those of you who were here for the walking meditation, I just want to say that when you're walking, the movement of your feet is coordinated with your breath. So as you are, so your feet are like this, one's in front of the other. As you are inhaling, this foot comes up. And as you exhale, it comes down. Inhale, exhale. I noticed a couple of you moving very slowly, and I know that you can't hold your breath that long. So just, you know, be aware of that. So how many of you know who Leonardo da Vinci is? Hands up, please. Good, glad to know that. Important guy. I just saw something recently, and because I'm a big Da Vinci fan, as I'm sure many of you are, I saw that it was Da Vinci's five life lessons. And as I was reading, I thought, oh, this is practice in a nutshell. So I thought I would share it with you today. We talk a lot in this practice about staying in the present moment and paying attention and observing and understanding this idea of emptiness, which is not really an idea. It is the reality of no separation, that actually there's no such thing as a permanent abiding nature for anything, including us, but everything is interconnected. So that's what emptiness is. And we also talk about developing character. It sort of happens very naturally when you do practice for a long period of time. So as I say, recently I saw this article on Da Vinci, and I thought that, oh, this is perfect because in the past, long before I came to practice, what I realized was I would be reading something, fiction, nonfiction, and something would strike me and say, yes, that, I agree with that. That is my actual experience. I have to understand, I didn't have a lot of experience at that point. I was only in my 20s. But the fact is, eventually when I read a book on Zen practice, every page was, that too. It was surprising because it was like it was all in one place. So the fact is, wisdom is not just found in Zen practice. It is found everywhere and all around you. So this was Da Vinci's take in the 1500s. The first one, never stop learning. So this person wrote, the quintessential Renaissance man, Leonardo, believed that the mind was meant to be used, challenged, and continually expanded. Da Vinci wrote, the acquisition of any knowledge is always of use to the intellect because it may thus drive out useless things and retain the good. Useless things. All that stuff that's going through our minds all day long. And when we sit down in meditation, we suddenly become aware of all that stuff, right? So to Da Vinci, learning was never wasted. Every new skill, observation, or experience to him was strengthening the mind and replacing ignorance with understanding. So da Vinci understood the importance of knowledge as a way to strengthen the mind, to replace ignorance with understanding. So we talk about the three poisons in Zen practice: thirsting desire, I want what I want; aversion, I don't want what I don't want; and then we either say ignorance or delusion. And it's ignorance of what? It is ignorance of our complete connection to everything. Because when you look around in the room right now, it appears that there are all these separate people. And of course, that is true also. But on some very fundamental reality, there is nothing separating any of us. In order to get here today, you had to get in a car, I'm assuming, unless you are one of those bicyclists that I envy. Somebody had to make that car. Somebody had to design that car. Somebody had to figure out how to get the fuel for that car. And then, even if you've got a car, you need roads. Somebody has to build the roads. Someone has to design the roads. Someone has to repair the roads. And then finally, you get here. Someone had to build this temple so that when you arrived, it was ready for you. Nothing in your life is without connection to everything else. At the end of his life, the Buddha told his Sangha, this is after 50 years of teaching, he said, "Forget everything I've said to you. Be a light unto yourself." Not because his words weren't wise and valuable, but because he understood that what he was talking about always was his experience. And he had these wonderful enlightenment experiences of exactly what I was just talking about, of no separation. But he understood that his experience is not your experience. The best any of us can do is talk about it, which is, what we say, the finger pointing at the moon. If the moon is the understanding, we can point to it, but each one of us has to understand it for ourselves. So he said, "Forget everything I've said, because it's just going to get in your way of you trusting your own experience. And where are you going to get that experience? Sitting on this cushion, watching what arises in meditation, watching what you grab onto, a thirsting desire. Ooh, I need to think about that. I need to plan what I'm going to do tomorrow. Oh, I need to think about what I'm having for dinner tonight," right? Crazy stuff. Or the other, "I really don't want to have that conversation with that person. I'm really upset with them," right? Or the delusion category is, "Oh, I'm not in either of those categories, and I'm just going to sit here and daydream. I'm just going to watch stuff come and go, and oh, this is so boring." Boring is not bad. Boring might be the settling of getting ready to quiet the mind. So how do we do this? How do we strengthen the mind? The first thing I would say is, please be curious. Ask questions. The best thing to do when you're in a new situation with new people, ask them about themselves. And ask them sincerely, like you really want to know about them. They might never remember to ask you a question about yourself, but they will feel seen by you. And you will have learned something about them. So first of all, be curious. But most of all, be curious about what's going on in here in yourself. And when answers arise, be honest with yourself. Because you might not always like what arises. But we first ask the questions, and then we look seriously at what's arising as the answers. So the second thing is, don't judge what you don't understand. So the author says Leonardo returned to this idea more than once in his notebooks. He wrote many notebooks, journals, basically, seeing it as a foundation of wisdom. Da Vinci observed that nothing can be loved or hated unless it is first known. I think many of us would agree with the first part, hard to love without knowing. But I think many of us succumb to the second of hating when we don't really know something. It's in our language, right? We use the word hate so casually. Oh, I hate that kind of ice cream. No, you dislike it. You don't necessarily hate it. That's a very strong word. But Da Vinci has to remind us that understanding comes before there's any meaningful response, before you can really form an opinion. But of course, we form opinions all the time about everything, whether we have any notion about it or not. And if you look at Da Vinci's work, you will see that this is true because before painting humans, he studied anatomy at length to understand all of the muscles of the hand, how the wrist works, how the hips work, the physiognomy of the head. All of this he studied before he ever sat down to draw and paint. Genuine understanding must come before any meaningful opinion can be formed. How often are we making decisions based on little more than a preference or someone else's opinion? I mean, I don't know about you, but when I was growing up, my parents had very particular political opinions. And, what did I know? I was just a kid. And so what tends to happen is you take in what your parents are saying and then you profess to believe that without very much information. It took years of educating myself once I left home to decide what I believed and what my experience was. That didn't mean that my parents' ideas or opinions were not valid, but they were valid for them. This is what we're trying to always say in practice. It doesn't matter. You can listen to hundreds of Dharma talks, read 1,000 Dharma books, and you can agree with them. You can say, oh, yes, as I said at the beginning. But until you sit down and have this experience for yourself of yes, it's not really true. You don't actually know. So there's a really famous poem called the Xin Xin Ming. And it starts right away. It doesn't beat around the bush at all. It says, the great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. How many of you have no preferences? Me too. Lots of preferences. Okay. So he makes it sound so simple. Oh, there's no problem. Just don't have any preferences. Well, of course you have preferences. One of your preferences is you wanted to be here today rather than someplace else. And that was a good preference. Thank you very much. But he goes on. When love and hate are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised. This poem predates Da Vinci, and they came to the same conclusion. The Xin Xin Ming says, make the smallest distinction. And heaven and earth are set infinitely apart. As soon as I have an opinion about something, I have concretized it. That is how I feel. You know, I'm not fond of wearing glasses, but I have three different glasses I have to wear. As soon as I say to myself, I don't like wearing glasses, I am going to suffer because I have to wear them. Right now, I wrote my my lecture in 12-point type, which makes it possible not to use my glasses. But when I go back to my old paperbacks of Dickens or Tolstoy, those paperbacks are written in 8-point type. It's very hard to read. So when you make these distinctions all the time, I like this, I don't like that, I hate this, I love that, you are inevitably going to suffer, because now you've made a line. As some people say, I've drawn a line in the sand, and this is how I feel, and to heck with how you feel. And so now we find ourselves a nation. I saw a wonderful opinion title in the New York Times the other day. If this country were a marriage, we would be headed for divorce. We have drawn this line. There's your idea and there's my idea, and they never cross over. That is not going to work in the long run. In Zazen, in our meditation, thoughts are constantly arising. Even, you know, I've been doing this practice over 40 years, more than 40. And when I'm sitting, thoughts are still arising. I mean, I'm sorry if that's disappointing, but this is what the brain does. The brain secretes thoughts. So maybe a different way to think about it, as a teacher Gil Franso once said, is we are thoughting. Thoughting is a bit different than thinking. Thoughting just means some thought arises. Thinking is when I say, ooh, I like that thought, and we grab a hold of it. Or, well, I don't like that thought, but we grab a hold of it too. And then we start thinking. So there's a very famous phrase by Zen Master Dogen. Think of not thinking. Not thinking? What kind of thinking is that? Non-thinking. I have struggled with that for years. Non-thinking I equate now with thoughting. It just arises and we let it go or not. When we grab a hold of them, we could be doing any number of things. We could be planning. We could be worrying. We could bring up old emotions from 10, 15, 20 years ago and relive that whole emotional feeling of something that is long over. It's amazing how it can come up so strongly, right? But when these preferences and opinions, this love, hate, like, don't like, are absent, suddenly things take on a new clarity. But to get there, we may need to ask a question. In the first place, when a thought arises, it's a really good idea to ask the question, really? Are you sure? Because many of the thoughts that arise in our head are not ours. They were given to us by other people, starting with our parents and our siblings and our aunts and uncles and friends and teachers. If you were told when you were 7 years old that you cannot carry a tune, and therefore you have never sung all of this time, you should ask yourself, is it true? And second, does it matter? We have a lot of old tapes in our head that get in our way, but we have to realize they're there. That's why being curious is so important. And to ask yourself, really, is that really true? Is it true right now? Maybe it was true yesterday. Maybe it was true 5 years ago. Is it actually true for me and my experience right now? And what we begin to notice is that much of one arises. I don't know about the rest of you, but there are certain kinds of thoughts that over and over. Habitual thinking patterns. And you can break them by asking, wait a minute, why am I thinking about that again? What is that? Where did that come from? Because those thought patterns generally do not contribute to genuine understanding, as Da Vinci expresses it, kindness or compassion. Because remember, nothing can be loved or hated unless it is fully known. So you're probably familiar with the four box theory. In the first box, I know what I know. In the second box, I know what I don't know. In the third box, maybe I don't know what I do know. And then there's the fourth box. I don't know what I don't know. So in the second box, in my case, I could say, I know what I don't know. I do not know calculus. I can tell you right now, math has never been my strong point. But the next one, I may not know what I do know. Sometimes we surprise even ourselves. Somebody asks a question and like, oh, I actually know about that. I didn't think I did. But it is the fourth box that always gets us into trouble. We don't know what we don't know. Especially if you go to another country, this becomes eminently clear because you cause all kinds of faux pas because their cultural norms are so different than yours. So we were just talking the other day, and I was doing tea ceremony practice, and we were talking about bowing in Japan and how, depending on who you're bowing to, you have all these different levels of bows. Also, depending on who you're talking to, and especially if you're a woman, there are different forms of address and actually almost a different language. And so when I was cramming for 3 months in Japanese, the woman who taught me the most formal of the language. And so there I am on my way, getting ready to go home. I'm on the Shinkansen, their bullet train, and I'm drawing in my journal. And these young girls, I think there were three or four of them, are kind of sneaking up behind me, looking over my shoulder because they can see I'm drawing something. And so I turned around and in my terrible Japanese, but very formal, I asked them if they liked to draw. They all started giggling. And I only realized later it was because I was speaking to them as if they were their grandmother's age, learning the most formal thing, right? They had never been spoken to like that before because children have, you speak to children at a different level. So we have to understand there is so much in the fourth box. And that allows us also to be more compassionate when someone does something that we think, well, how come you didn't know that? Well, maybe they didn't. So the third thing that Da Vinci said was, live each day with purpose. I love this. He understood that the value of life is found not in the number of years, but in how meaningfully we use the time that is given us. When my father died at 73, and I was at the memorial, all of his friends came up and, oh, he died too young. But 2 weeks before that, one of my students from school who had just turned 15, died from cystic fibrosis. And I thought, my father had 73 years, most of that as an adult, doing the things he wanted to do, working, traveling, having a family. This 15-year-old didn't get to do any of that. We don't know how long we have. We think we've got ages. We're hoping that we're going to be one of those people that lives a long, long time. And I hope you do too, because there is always something to learn. Even when life gets difficult, and as you get older, there are things that are going to happen that are going to surprise you. But you learn new things. Like when I found out that I had glaucoma, which means that my peripheral vision is severely impaired. It means I really shouldn't drive at night because you need a lot of light to see. I'm fine driving at this point in the daytime. But what it meant, I didn't realize it until one of my friends, who was always asking me to come and give a guest lecture in San Jose 3 or 4 times a year, writes and says, "We really would like you to come and give a lecture on this particular day." And without even thinking, I wrote back and said, "Oh, I'd love to do that. I'll put it on my calendar." And only after I got off the email, I thought, oh, I could drive there in the light, but how am I going to get home? And so for the first time in my life, I had to write a dear friend and say, "Would you be willing to go with me and be my chauffeur?" She was so happy to be asked. And she has done it several times for me since. And we always go out to dinner first and enjoy each other's company. And so suddenly I'm in a position of having to ask for help that I have never had to do before, being Miss Independence. It's very good for me. So even when you think that you don't want to welcome those things, there is always something to learn. So, Da Vinci wrote, "As a day well spent procures a happy sleep, so a life well employed procures a happy death." Just as a fulfilling day brings peace at the end of the evening, a life guided by purpose of some kind, any kind, is going to bring you satisfaction when you look back on it. On the han, that wooden mallet, in many temples, there's a phrase written. It says, "Awaken to the great matter. Life is swiftly passing. Don't waste time." And the longer the mallet hits, words disappear. But it doesn't matter because you've been hitting that mallet for years. Don't waste time. The value of life is not found in the number of years, but in living a meaningful life. Your life is limited. My life is limited because we have a body. You are going to get sick. That's inevitable. Hopefully, you are going to grow old, but that is not inevitable. And then someday, you are going to die. And everyone else in your life is also going to be dying. And as you get to be my age, more and more people are getting very ill and dying. We get caught up in our daily life, shopping, cooking, raising our families, taking vacations. And the next thing we know, we're old. And death is like right around the corner. But also, actually, it's always been right around the corner. So how do we understand this idea of living meaningfully? What would it mean to live a day well spent or a life well employed? To live meaningfully, means to formulate your deepest inner request. I remember the first time I heard someone say this, a teacher, and I thought, what request? What are they talking about? This is your most fundamental question. Somewhere deep down inside of you, there is a question. I finally formulated to myself that the question was, how could I live a life that matters? And then, of course, you have to pull that apart. What do we mean by matters? And each of you is going to be able to formulate this in your own way. But realizing what that question is going to give your life purpose right there. What is the thing that you most want to know? To live a life that matters is probably the same thing as what Da Vinci is saying. A day well spent, a life well employed. Because our inmost request is about our hope, our desire that at the end of the day, when we are dying, that we have done something useful in our life, that we are loved, and that we love. You're not going to be caring about your bank account or the amount of land you own. You are not going to be worried about whether you are famous or whether you have a lot of followers on TikTok. No. You're going to be wanting whoever is standing next to your bed at that point, telling you how much they love you and how much you matter to them. One Tibetan Lama years ago, I heard that his daily practice when he wakes up is to ask himself, how can I be of service today? Such a great question. The answer is different for each of us. Taking care of an elderly parent, a young child, speaking with a coworker with compassion, driving carefully on the road, not taking offense even when it is given. There are so many ways to be of service. But when we are of service, and so many times it's something very small, like, oh, please, you go first. There's a little bit of joy that arises right there. So who is the first person to experience that joy? You, me. The other person being allowed to go first, they might like that too, but that feeling of joy that arises, it is instantaneous in your head. There's a pleasure center in your head that immediately feels good. So Da Vinci also says that the fourth one is that character matters more than wealth or accomplishment. This by one of the greatest artists that ever lived. Leonardo believed that the greatest measure of a person was not what they possessed or achieved, but their character. He wrote, "That is not riches which may be lost. Virtue is our true good and the true reward of its possessor." Wealth, status, recognition, they come and go. How many of you can remember Secretary of State from 5 years ago? At the time, they were the most important person. They were in every, column in the newspaper. Fame is fleeting. Wealth may also be fleeting, but even if it's not, it will never buy you what is actually the most important thing. Status also is not going to buy you the love and admiration of others. Because a lot of times the way you got that wealth and status was by stepping on other people as you climbed the ladder. But integrity, compassion, wisdom, no one can take those away from you unless you let them. At the end of our life, what we're wanting is to know that we did something useful and that we are loved. I don't even need admiration, but to know that maybe I did live a life that matters and that that may go on because of ripples to other people's lives. I know that the words character and virtue sound really old-fashioned, when in fact, they're really the only thing that is left to you. In the Five Recollections of Thich Nhat Hanh, he basically says that you are going to get sick, you are going to grow old, and then you're going to die, and everything is going to be taken away from you and everyone you love. And the only thing that is going to be left to you are your actions. Our actions are our only true belongings. Our actions are the ground upon which we stand. Our actions must be grounded in character, the qualities of integrity, authenticity, being really who you are completely, compassion, wisdom, and courage, the courage to maintain that integrity. And no matter what anybody else is saying, it's that old joke where your parents, when you said, well, Linda gets to go, and your mother says to you, well, if Linda says to jump off the bridge, are you going to do it? It's exactly that. No, you have to have the integrity to stand up for what you believe, despite everybody else maybe disagreeing and saying, oh, live and let live, or let's be nice, or no, if it's wrong, it's wrong. Da Vinci says, riches may be lost, but virtue is our true good and the true reward of its possessor. It's not something to lord over anybody or feel smug about. That wouldn't be virtue, actually. It is about being upright. It's a wonderful book on the precepts of this practice by Reb Anderson, who is a teacher emeritus for Green Gulch Farm. And the title of the book is Being Upright. And so we have an upright posture and we have an upright mind. Finally and perfectly, Da Vinci says to pay attention to the world around you. He believed that understanding begins with careful observation. He said, all our knowledge has its origins in our perceptions. No, he doesn't say your observations. He says perceptions. He expressed his belief that discovering begins with paying attention to the world around us. Before any of his theories or inventions or his art were created, he realized there needed to be a willingness to look closely at the world, to learn from his experience. In this particular practice, actually, observation is one of the key components. Albert Schweitzer once famously said, example is not the main thing in influencing others. It is the only thing. Teaching by example. This is what parents do with children. It is what teachers in schools do. It is what we do here. We teach always by example. Nothing I'm saying matters. Watch teachers, any teacher in your life, watch your elders. Everything they're doing speaks much louder than what they're saying. They have to be able to walk their talk. So, The problem with observation and teaching by example is that the individuals need to know to observe. This is a problem in Zen practice, actually. The teacher can be offering their example as much as possible, but if nobody's watching, so years ago, years and years ago, it was the middle of winter at the temple where I was practicing, and there was a little heat in this building, and the floor was always freezing. But my teacher, when we would do the walking meditation, always did it barefoot. So I always did it barefoot because I figured he was 22 years older than me. If he could suffer the freezing floor, so could I. But later, other members of the Sangha came up and said, "Why aren't you wearing socks? It's freezing cold." Said, "Because my teacher is not wearing socks." This was like a revelation to them. It's like, oh, they hadn't thought to look. All our knowledge has its origins in our perceptions. So I think I've mentioned this example once before, but it bears repeating, of a time when I was teaching an art class in watercolors. And the first thing that we had to do was a little sketch. We were drawing flowers that day. Particularly, we were drawing nasturtiums. If you know about nasturtiums, you know that the leaf is shaped like this. The stem comes here and creates a little round circle where it comes into the leaf. And then there are veins that come out this way at angles. And it's usually five or seven veins per leaf. So always the problem when you're teaching art is there's the kid that wants to rush through and already be done while you have other children that are still looking at the paper. So on this day, naturally, there was a child who was anxious to show me his drawing of the nasturtium leaf so that he could then get to the painting part. So he brings up the drawing and it's a circle and there's a dot in the middle and then there's four lines radiating out from it. Now, as a teacher, you don't want to discourage your young student. So I was very careful and I said, interesting. Can you go get me that leaf that you were drawing from? So he brings it over and we lay the leaf next to his drawing. I said, okay, so first of all, this thing that you have in the center, this dot, where is that on the leaf? Oh, down here. And can you count the number of veins on this leaf for me? There were seven. I said, and how many are in your drawing? Four. I said, I would like you to go back now and try to draw exactly what you are seeing, not your idea about it. This is the problem. We have ideas about everything, and so we are never actually seeing. They say that we make up our mind when we meet a new person in 5 minutes or less, based solely on our perceptions of that individual, without giving them a chance even to open their mouth. We need to pay attention to the world around us. We need to carefully observe, because otherwise we will continue to suffer from thirsting desire, from aversion, and from ignorance. We will always be coming from that place of preferences and opinions, and we will never actually have a chance to see what's happening in front of us. So I would like to end with a poem by Shantideva. May I be a guard for those who are protectorless, a guide for those who journey on the road. For those who wish to cross the water, may I be a boat, a raft, a bridge. May I be an isle for those who yearn for land, and a lamp for those who long for light, for all who need a resting place, a bed, and for those who need a servant, may I be their servant. May we all live a meaningful life. Thank you. So as usual, I think I've gone over my time limit.
2 minutes.
2 minutes, yes. So I think what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna skip the questions. I'm gonna be up in the room. If you have questions, you can ask me there. I'm happy to talk to you. The most important thing is ask yourself your inmost, deepest question. Figure out what it is. It may take you a while to get there. It certainly took me a long time. But it is well worth looking for. Thank you. Thank you, those of you online.
After the talk, Jim.
May our intentions be pleased every being and place. With the true merit of Buddha's way, being fine of hopes, I am to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. They want to wait. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become. And one last thing. We just heard a siren. When I was 6 years old, the nun who was my teacher gave me a practice which I continued the rest of my life, which is to stop when you hear a siren and offer well-being for who is ever in trouble. Let us take just a moment to do that. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.